I'm Christopher Lydon, with the only man I know who has made a name and a career thinking about the internet as a philosophical problem. David Weinberger's new book is called Too Big to Know. It's all about what the digital revolution is doing to knowing, to science, to wisdom, to Emerson's old idea of a universal mind to which every single one of us in the human species has access. But David, I also read this book as a sort of 10-year report on the digital decade, which is also the span of our friendship and of our conversations. To me, it's a reminder of what the VC guys say, that it's always surprising how little changes in a year or two, and it's amazing how much changes in 10 years or so. Play a game with me, if you will, and name your own top five list of what is significantly new over the 10 years. Could be Chowhound for foodies, or the Obama election in 08, or a new science boom all around us. Whatever you think confirms your vision of a new system of knowledge.
If it's a 10-year horizon, then Wikipedia's pretty much got to be on that list, because it maybe just squeezes in under the wire. But Wikipedia is an epical proof of concept, in addition to being the world's greatest encyclopedia. So would not want to have a list that didn't have Wikipedia on it.
Why? Because of its collectivity, because of its freedom from size constrictions, its correctability?
Yes, all those things, but also because it is dramatic proof that things that we would not have thought possible are in fact possible, that we can build an encyclopedia at that scale. It was always assumed that one of the advantages of encyclopedia was that because it had relatively few topics, so 65,000 topics in Britannica, that it was able to focus on those and get them right. And, you know, we know that get it right is more or less a fiction, but a useful one. Wikipedia, 3.8 million articles in English, it was not conceivable 10 years ago, much less that it would reach the quality that it has, which is pretty good. Overall, the quality of Wikipedia is pretty good. So it proves something, it proves that we can do things together in a disorganized fashion,
right,
without a lot of centralization that we would not have thought possible before. And that lesson extends far beyond the boundaries of knowledge. It's an important lesson for the species. So there's that.
With, for me, the greatest benefit that it has external links. You can go far and wide from Wikipedia to learn more or different or contrary or text or anything. Go ahead.
So it's also tremendously important in how it reflects the change in how we structure knowledge. It didn't change it. It's using a hyperlink form. But if you look at Wikipedia and you compare it to traditional encyclopedias, the fact that it's linked is fundamentally important about it. We take it for granted because it's on the web, but it changes it so that, for example, in the Britannica, if you look up philosophy, it's 180,000 contiguous words. All right, it's three books worth of stuff. Go to Wikipedia, it's around 9,000 words, which is actually very long for a Wikipedia article. So if you do the head-to-head, it looks like Wikipedia is, you know, it's got 1/120th of what Britannica has. But that's, of course, wrong, because Wikipedia, in fact, those 9,000 words, like every third word is a link. And so if you want to do the head-to-head, you have to start following the links and say, well, okay, I'll follow the Aristotle link, that's philosophy, and the Plato one. But how about the one about faith? Because we've had 2,500 or 2,000 years of argument about whether faith is part of philosophy or its opposite. And so you'll make up your mind about whether faith is in fact within philosophy, and you'll do your own count. But there isn't a right answer to that question. They've taken, because it's a linked format, and Wikipedia obviously well understands that, the web is a linked format, the nature of topics and thus of expertise, and thus how we see ideas go together, all fundamentally changed. Everything we knew about them is wrong. You know, divide up the world into pieces, let people master those pieces, and the really, 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 really smart ones get to do that for Britannica. Everything about that common form of how we built knowledge in reliable ways, undone in Wikipedia. Every aspect of it is undone, as if on purpose.
Bob Doerr was pointing out in the history of Wikipedia that Jimmy Wales originally had something like 16 articles and got stuck, didn't know where it was going to go, which is also the capacity of this beast to surprise its masters at every turn.
They had 16 articles. It was in the original version of it, because the original idea was they would curate. They would get experts and curate the articles. And as a result, over, I think it was over a year, they had 16 articles done. And once they decided that they would not have experts curating it and do what they currently do, that's when it started to scale. So, I mean, the overall lesson for the web, I think, is one that we knew 10 years ago, but needs continual reproof and re-emphasis, which is that, well, I guess it's two parts. First is the control doesn't scale. That if you want to control an organization, you can get it maybe to the size of an army, but you have to give up all sorts of things in order to manage that control. For example, everybody has to dress the same, and you have to have an extremely strict hierarchy, and that's how armies manage to scale. It turns out control does not scale beyond that point. So that's the first lesson. And the second is, when you don't scale control, when you allow disorganized groups to form and organize themselves in useful ways, you can do things at a scale you couldn't believe, you would never have believed before, such as 3.8 million articles in an encyclopedia.
In less than 10 years, astonishing. Next on your hit parade.
Oh, geez. I'm very fond of Reddit. It's been around for, I mean, 6 or 7 years, I think. So it's a little bit old, but it's really starting to take off now. It's getting a lot of notice for a few good reasons. So Reddit is a very simple sort of site. Anybody can nominate a link, you know, post a link, and then the readers there, thumbs up, thumbs down it, that determines what gets moved up. And then there are discussion threads. Discussion threads for a successful article, you know, at least be a few hundred. There was one recently that had 12,000 comments, but they also have, you can thumbs up, thumbs down those as well, and so you get community editing of the comments, and that seems to work pretty well. It's a pretty incisive community.
Comments on what, David? And how different from a like on your Facebook page?
So somebody will post a link to an article or something on the web. Frequently it's a funny picture or a cat photo. It's one of the things I find fascinating about Reddit. But sometimes it will be an important political statement or somebody who's gone through a devastating personal experience, somebody who wants to talk about it. So you post a link. People like the link or they don't. That is, if they thumbs up it, it becomes more visible. And then people comment on the content of that link. So one of the formats that they encourage is, if you are a person of note or somebody who's in an interesting job, then you can offer up what they call an IMI, which really means I am a radio broadcaster. I am Woody Harrelson. I am a hearing man married to a deaf woman or whatever. And you offer to answer questions. Ask me anything is the usual format. And so you have this person who is available for some number of hours, the community will swarm in a really quite wonderful way. So they'll ask questions that are generally better questions than you will hear on any broadcast or newspaper article. They're asking the questions people actually want answered. Frequently, they're uncomfortable questions, but they're generally the tone is quite respectful and polite, unless the person is dodging, giving baffle gab, or is being disrespectful to the process and to the community. Somebody asks a question, the person may choose to answer it, and then there will be a long thread, typically, of people at Reddit commenting, extracting, comparing, extrapolating, contradicting. Frequently, they'll spin off into repartee, sometimes silly repartee. There's a certain style of banter there that can be quite hilarious, the back and forth and the building on one another. It's a type of journalism that I simply haven't seen before. It's more frank. It's more detailed. It holds the person to account while usually treating them quite respectfully. And it intertwines this, I think, if the audience is getting to ask questions, audiences also like to talk with one another and to make jokes and to post in the funny link over here, and that's what they do. It's this weird and wonderful and very human form of community journalism. And at its best, which it frequently is, it's tremendously successful.
Next, on your representative innovations of the last 10 years.
There's an example that I borrow from Michael Nielsen, whose book Reinventing Discovery came out in December. This is an example not in his book because it was too new, but he uses when he talks. And it's of the very surprising data that came out of the Large Hadron Collider that says neutrinos look like they're traveling faster than light, which, if true, would upset all of relativity theory, or so I'm told, because, of course, I don't have the math to understand any of this. But that's sort of the point, or part of the point. Michael Nielsen points out that this very important This is not oddball science. This is the Large Hadron. This is the most important physics work going on. These results are startling. All of the work around them, the discussion around them, happened outside of the traditional peer-reviewed loops. So the original data, the original paper, was posted at archive.org, A-R-X-I-V. And archive has got to be on any list of important, you know, representative important sites in a tour of what's happened, at least to knowledge, on the net. Archive.org is a site where any scientist with any standing can post anything. And so people will post things before they sent them off for peer review, or while they're being peer reviewed, or a first draft, or data. And so that's where these findings were posted. Mm. Very responsible scientists. And over the course of a couple months, Michael says, over 80 other papers were posted there in response. And furthermore, it spread out immediately all across the web, in blog posts and tweets, the whole deal, the whole ecology jumped in. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the ecology of knowledge got filled out far more than it used to ever could be before. So that if you were a high-end physicist who wanted to discuss it, you could do it on the web, at archive, or wherever you wanted. That's where those discussions are having. And if you were somebody who doesn't have the math to understand relativity, like me, you could get explanations of it. And you could hear multiple explanations, and explanations that were disagreeing with one another and fleshing out. Whatever level you were at, there was not only primary work being done, but people explaining it and talking about it. And the reason why I really like this example is, first of all, it shows how you scale knowledge. That had this gone through the peer-reviewed process to get published in an important journal, which this paper certainly would have in the old days, had they chosen that route, it would have taken a year, year and a half, and that would be expedited, to have it go through peer review and have it be published. And then in the next issue, a few months later, there'd be some letters, and there'd be some newspaper coverage probably, page 3 of the Times. There'd be an article on this, interesting findings. Might even be a follow-up article, but that would be it. And if you read the Times article and you had a question about it because it wasn't quite at your level or whatever, you were stuck in the old days. Now every piece of the ecology is filled out, and the important work that's being done is being done in a scaled form that is very fast, lots of people, only because the control mechanisms have gone down. And so the old idea that we only got, that the peer review process was to protect us so that we got good science, well, yeah, it does that. But it also restricted science so severely that it couldn't work as quickly and as broadly as we wanted to. So I think this is a great example of that. It's also a great example of what I think is one of the most important things going on the net, and in the change in how knowledge works. It's that the knowledge lives in that network. It's the pieces connected and arguing with one another, not agreeing. That's where the knowledge is not only developed, that's where, in any real sense, knowledge lives. And it includes, it has value because it includes not just the original paper, and not, but all of the responses to it, all of which are different from, and in many cases disagree with, that original paper. Knowledge lives in networks. These networks have value because of the differences and disagreements among the pieces, which is an inversion of how knowledge used to work.
Is anybody seriously out of joint with the loss of peer review control, or in this case of the speed of light? I mean, don't they have to say, yeah, we found a better way?
So on the one hand, yes, and that is like Wikipedia in that it's a proof point. I mean, you point this out to anybody and they'll say, yeah, oh yeah, no, that's right. I mean, obviously this is the sort of thing that we want for that type of science, absolutely. The sticking point are tenure committees. Those 80 papers that were doing the right job, those scientists are not going to be able to present that to their tenure committee and say, see, I managed to get something published at archive.org where everything is published, where there is no rejection process. There is an institutional issue here, that the institutions that pay scientists don't count the work that's being done that is the real work of science these days. Yeah. That's an overstatement, but that is the issue.
It sounds like a version of what WikiLeaks does to the New York Times and Standard Media, too. It can just flood the zone with better information. And what's to defend the old institution?
Yes, but in case of science, so there's some fields where I think the argument is more trenchant, more worrisome anyway. In the case of science, it seems clear to me that and I think to most people, as you say, that we're better off having this type of open discussion, rapid deployment of data and the linking of data, which is something else that we should probably talk about. This is exactly what science wants, has always wanted. It's always been that way. Scientists present their data. They want as many eyes looking at it as possible, their evidence, their hypotheses, mm-hmm. and to engage in discussion and public discussion. This is the very model. That model is not new. It's now we're able to accomplish it. It's hard to imagine how this hurts the institutions of science, that why they would not evaluate the online presence of scientists in these debates. It's harder to gauge the influence, mm-hmm. but it seems to me to be, I can't imagine what the argument is against counting that stuff as part of your validation as a scientist.
Archive.org, sold. Take a banal example, but you can get your teeth into this one. Chowhound. You mention it. I love it. My daughters, the cooks, call it the crystal meth professional kitchens, where people can ask any question, get any bit of advice, find out who's got the best ribs in Omaha or whatever. Another illustration of the sort of non-hierarchical, open, active, living knowledge system. Does that still make any rank in your list?
No, only because I don't use it. I mention it because there's a story about Calvin Trillin tracking down a mysterious Chinese chef who seems to move from strip mall Chinese restaurant to strip mall Chinese restaurant. It's a very New Yorker sort of thing, where Chowhound was instrumental in sort of crowdsourcing knowledge about where this mysterious chef was. I happen not to use the site. I use a site called TripAdvisor. Very popular. I think probably now the dominant site for travel advice. That is a completely crowdsourced. You want to know what hotel to stay in? Mm. You'll find out from people who have stayed there. When you're at the hotel's page, you can see either the official photos of the hotel from the brochure, but people can also upload their own. And you see what the bathroom actually looks like. You'll see how worn the furniture actually is. It's not always negative by any means. Frequently, the place looks great.
Put the Arab eruption of 2011, a year ago, somewhere on your chart of what digital knowledge has done for us.
So as you know, the analysis of the role of the internet in Arab Spring has become a touchstone for a broader argument about the effect of the internet on society. Because the optimists and the promoters of the internet, which I certainly count myself as, say, look what we did, look what the internet did. It enabled this. And there's been pushback, which I think is extremely healthy. Malcolm Gladwell is maybe the most well-known of the back pushers, saying, baloney. You know, you're saying the internet did it? The internet didn't do it. Years of oppression did it. And
yeah.
Which is, you know, not the greatest argument, because nobody actually said the internet did it, although I'm about to. In a modified way. And furthermore, it would have happened even if there wasn't an internet. So I think elements of that argument actually are silly, are wrong. No, the internet didn't do it, of course. And of course, years of oppression account for it. But media do have an effect on what we are able to do, first of all. Right, so there are things that you can do on the internet. The things that the internet made way easier, made so easy that they reached a tipping point, if I may, and people actually did them. So it's really easy on the internet for crowds to spread news about where there's a demonstration or where there's been an attack and stay away from there. That sort of crowd organization Clay Shirky talks about brilliantly. Yeah, maybe you could have done it before, but it was much harder and much riskier. Now it's dead easy. So I think you do have to mix that in. The alternative is to say media have no effect on anything. And I don't think anybody actually believes that. I think we do. We don't. So one of the issues is that we don't have a theory of media in our culture that I can tell, at least not one that is widely accepted. We don't have an idea about what effect media have on culture, on politics, and all the rest of it. And when you talk with somebody and start to try to delve into it, it turns out that we have a rag bag of beliefs that are self-incoherent, and I don't have a replacement for it. I wish I did. So let me very briefly make the case that I'm reluctant to make, but I will, which is, no, the internet didn't cause Arab Spring. Of course not. But I think that it's worth exploring anyway whether the experience of the internet by itself outside of politics and to a larger degree even outside of culture, whether that experience tends to bring certain values and beliefs to us. It's highly unpopular to say what I just said, to answer that question positively. You are immediately a techno-determinist if you say that, somebody who believes that technology by itself has an effect on people. And that's generally a fallacy, but I want to make at least a weak case for considering an aspect of it. So we know the internet can be used as a tool of repression, of course. Technology is just a tool. You can use it for whatever. Nevertheless, even in oppressed regions where the internet is tightly controlled, if you go on the internet, you learn a few things, just about inevitably. You learn that there is, first of all, a tremendous amount of information in the world. You learn that there are, even within an oppressed, repressed internet, you learn that there is a wide range of values and opinions. You learn that things can be linked, and maybe most important from the political sphere, maybe, is that you learn that you have a voice. You may be frightened of saying some things, but nevertheless, you have a voice that you did not have before.
Right.
It seems to me that there should be some type of political consequences to those things that maybe you learn from the internet simply by being on the internet. I have asked a couple of the activists, in particular one of the Tunisian activists, do you think that the internet by itself helped form the political consciousness that gave the Tunisians the spirit to rise up? And he said, yeah.
We'll come back to this question of mobilizing the knowledge and translating it into power, which I think is very incomplete. But I would say Nate Silver's arrival at the New York Times as a New York Times staple now, from his own independent website, a sports nut who became a political nut, very, very sophisticated about polling, reading polls, combining polls, judging them all together. That's a gain for the American political world, in my opinion. Do you want to measure that?
It's a wonderful story that a baseball stats guy is able to retarget and become, I think, you know, the premier interpreter of political data. Is pretty phenomenal. So the part of the
and that the New York Times would hire him. I mean,
yes. I'm resisting taking the hiring by the New York Times as the validation of Nate Silver.
No, it's the validation of the New York Times.
yes. So for me, maybe what I think this may be point, but it's representative of the interweaving of these two worlds in a way that I think 10 years ago we might have thought was less likely. And I'm still not sure how these weavings are going to work out. I mean, what's going to happen to newspapers even as august as the New York Times is still to some degree up in the air. But the continual experimentation of in how to take two systems that really don't operate together very well. I mean, networks are, and when I say networks, I mean of the internet sort. Networks are really a special form of social organization that we haven't had exactly. We've always had networks of various sorts, but not of the type that we have on the internet. And they are very resistant to filtered sources and to hierarchies. Those things find it difficult to make their way onto the net in a useful and reasonable way.
I mourn the damage to the New York Times in a certain way. I used to cover politics for the New York Times. On the other hand, I think it's an overwhelming gain. I mean, the New York Times was a network. I remember Richard Rovere in The New Yorker, this goes back at least 50 years, said the definition of the American establishment was basically the readership of the New York Times. Teddy White said the same thing, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, that he had a whole chapter, practically, that the New York Times loved, that basically the world wakes up and finds out what's going on in the New York Times. But it's a closed, hierarchical, in many ways biased, in some ways narrow fraternity. It's a network, a membership network. It's not correct. Our methods were not particularly good. We didn't call them anything like as well as Nate Silver does. I think we've been liberated from that. But stand back. On each of the examples, you're building out the fundamental argument of your book that knowledge has been transformed. It is now anti-hierarchical. It is open. It's alive. It's out there. There's no smartest person in the room. It's the room that's smart. Make the general point. I think we all think of it now. We think of it in this cloud, even if we don't understand it, that there is a cloud somewhere and everything is accessible.
The way that I think about this is viewing traditional knowledge as silently absorbing the limitations of its medium, which is all that it could do. Its medium was paper, of course. And we ended up taking those limitations as, in fact, what exalts knowledge. And as soon as you have something that is alternative to that, you have another way of doing it, those limitations suddenly stand forth in strong relief, and knowledge now begins to take on the characteristics of its new medium, with its strengths and limitations as well. So one could say this is good or it's bad, and it is both good and bad. But ultimately, the new form of knowledge, if nothing else, is closer to how knowledge actually works and how humans stand in relation to the world. It's a better representation in its form. The old form of knowledge aimed at certainty. It was justified true belief, is a classical formulation from Plato, as you know. So over the course of 2,500 years, justified became generally became narrower and narrower, what constitutes justification, and knowledge became that about which we are certain. So it was incoherent to say it could be one or the other. I know it's one. No, you can't say those two things. You only say you know when you've driven out uncertainty. For 2,500 years, until very recently, and I mean within on the order of decades, we assumed, deeply assumed, that to know what something was to know what its place in the universe was. Mm-hmm. And to say that, well, there isn't an order of the universe, a single order, would have been taken quite literally as a sign of madness or of heresy. Now you have to explain this idea to people. I mean, this was central to our culture, 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. Now you have to, you know, the kids, you got to explain to them, and it's like you're explaining medieval philosophy, and you are, but it's also you're also explaining everything up to this century or you know, sometime in the 20th century.
Can I give you my living metaphor of the whole thing? I mean, when I was first at the New York Times, one of the things new recruits had to do was to spend few weeks in New York. I was part of the Washington Bureau, but you live in New York for a while and you go to all the meetings, the morning meeting, the evening meeting. It was the evening meeting that fascinated me. Probably a dozen senior editors around a big table, and basically they're arguing over what goes on page one and where it should be laid out. It was then an 8-column format, and the right-hand column was the most important thing in God's own view that took place on the planet the day before. But then the culture editor made his point, the financial editor, the foreign editor, you name it, and then they basically pushed and pulled, and then they sort of burned the incense and said the mumbo-jumbo, and poof, you had a definition of what happened in the world the day before. And, of course, it could be replated and updated, but basically that was a decision reached in a very nearly sacramental fashion about what really counted. And that was the era when Walter Cronkite would say, and that's the way it is. Nowadays, we are at least several steps down the road toward what you guys call the semiotic democracy, in which all sorts of people can pipe up around the world and say, no, Walter, that's not the way it is. I'm in Burma, or I'm in East Kansas or something, and it's not that way at all. This seems to me a huge step forward.
Yes, so that's actually a wonderful example. So we had to have a half-hour news for economic reasons and attention spans and the rest of it, so we'd have nightly half-hour news. But the notion that that was the news, that there is such a thing as the news, we lost that not so long ago. And so that old construction that there's a half, that the news consists of what fits into a newspaper or into that half-hour slot, that does not reflect the actual nature of the world, which is it's overwhelmingly busy. And second of all, what matters, what is the news, depends hugely upon where you are and what your interests are. And the new world reflects that. And there are problems with that, which we can talk about. There are deep problems, desperate problems about allowing people to gather news based upon what they're interested in. Nevertheless, that is a far better reflection of what it means to be a human being. That is, to be in a world that is overwhelming and that matters to you in various ways. That's what it means to be a human being. And the notion that there is a person or a group of people who can filter and give you the essence of it, and now you've got it, that's not a human view. That's something else, but it's not a human view.
Describe this room of yours, and what's the difference between a good room and a bad room? Not so much a smart room or a stupid room, but how do we shape these rooms, or how do they get shaped?
Well, so the smart room metaphor is really a metaphor simply for a web of people who are connected in any of the ways that you can connect on the web. What makes a room smarter is if the members of it are contributing in such a way that anybody who is participating is learning more and at two levels than he or she could before. So learning more both in terms of the content, but perhaps more important, learning more about the play of ideas and their inevitable differences. Because that's again, that's what it means to be human in this world. And we do have a tendency to make a mistake, a fallacy, that was reinforced by the nature of the old media, which is interpretation is a weakness. If you're interpreting something, you're injecting your subjectivity into it, and you're not, that knowledge is at risk. The real knowledge comes to you in the voice of the beloved late Walter Cronkite, preferably, with a great deal of authority, and that burden is relieved from you, and that's the truth. But I take it as self-evident that the truth about being human is that we're always interpreting, and we're disagreeing with other people's in their interpretation, and that's both the bane and the greatest joy of life. That's what knowledge is.
David Weinberger, that I think Ralph Waldo Emerson, middle of the 19th century, anticipated the whole web. I mean, he was an interactive culture guy. He had a genomic understanding of the human brain and its universality. He was endlessly curious, endlessly enthusiastic. But he describes this room you're talking about, to me, almost precisely in a fragment of his essay on history. He writes, "The mind is one." Speaking of the universal mind, "there is one mind common to all individual men and women. Every man is an inlet to the same and to all of the same. He that is once admitted to the right of reason is made a free man of the whole estate. What Plato has thought, he may think. What a saint has felt, he may feel. What at any time has befallen any man, he can understand. Who has access to this universal mind is a party to all that is or can be done, for this is the only and sovereign agent." Is he not talking about your room?
I hate to say no, but I don't think so. it's such wonderful writing. I want it to be right, but I disagree with it. It's not what I'm talking about.
Explain.
Okay, so the characteristic of the room, that of a knowledge network, that makes it a better way of knowing than any of the individuals, is that that network is in disagreement with itself. In one way or another, the value comes from the fact that it is not a unified mind, but that the pieces are arguing.
He didn't say unified, universal. It's that's different. He doesn't, and I don't think he's advocating particular answers.
So universal in the sense of anybody can access this, whatever, this cloud, whatever it is. I'd actually push back on two pieces of it. One is the extent to which this cloud can be thought of as a mind as opposed to a set of people who are arguing with one another and agreeing. So conversation in general is a matter of two people who agree a great deal on something, same language, same basic values, same conversational norms, who are disagreeing about something small. So it's like you and me, who have enormous similarities in background, culture, language, and the rest of it, and we're disagreeing about, in some sense, very small, a passage, an Emerson passage. That's good. This is how conversation works. It requires a huge amount of sameness, and then you iterate on the differences. But it's the differences that make a web smarter than the individuals. So I want to make sure that in the discussion of the picturing of how this is coming together, that we understand that the pieces actually aren't coming together, that it's their differences that is making this valuable. Depending on how one understands that passage, I want to just reserve that.
I think Emerson would respect your amendment, your splitting of a hair there, but that's fine by me. The idea, though, of a non-hierarchical, living, approachable, universal access treasury of, again, exchange, conversation, inquiry, seems to me he's pretty well there. But
in that case, yes. So with that understanding, then we now have an infrastructure that embodies and enables that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not a small thing.
150 years later or whatever, along comes the software and the hardware. Let me throw out three things that I think are still missing in this after this digital decade. And I wonder what you think. Very broadly, there's the question of empathy in the best institutions of the social web, Facebook, for example. I mean, the real question in my mind is how many emotional, ethnic, geographic, religious, historical borders we're actually jumping. Secondly, it's a matter of wisdom. I'm still looking for the wisdom of the web. Maybe because Harold Bloom, you know, writes about the great wisdom writers going back to the Hebrew prophets or Walt Whitman, for that matter, as treasures of the old culture. And third is, to me, this question of power. About 10 years ago, and you and I knew Jim Moore well at that time, he wrote a much commented on article for the web on a blog. It was The Second Superpower Rears Its Beautiful Head, and it was about opposition to the forthcoming war in Iraq that was blooming all over the world, but especially on the internet. And almost 10 years later, we find ourselves in a very similar kind of all the old institutions, from the Pentagon to the New York Times to, you know, American politics in general, is paving a new way to war with Iran, despite what I think would be an even more overwhelming consensus on the web, if you could ask it, that this is folly. This is just one more illusion of a war that will make us safer. So what's the empathy score of the human exchange on the social web we're creating? And how do you feel about it, and what's to be done about it?
You ask such wonderfully impossible questions.
That's right. There's no simple answer here.
So there is, unfortunately, some evidence that we, even though we have access to this universal mind, which everybody else in the world who's connected on the web, which is a substantial portion of the world, that we are staying local. Global access, and we stay local. My friend Ethan Zuckerman has been working on this question, and it's a genuine splash of cold water in the face of internet optimists like me, who 10 years ago, 15 years ago, assumed that given access, we would avail ourselves of it, that we would run to embrace. But no, generally we don't. But it's not a simple thing to care about another culture, because cultures are made up of shared interests as well as shared values, and all that, but it's a set of people who share their interests. And so asking and who understand things based upon a set of very local, you know, situations. It's understanding is this massive context that enables us to understand pieces that come in. So it's never easy to embrace another culture, to understand it well.
You do just have to pack up and go.
To the place.
Yeah,
travel counts for a lot. I mean, it's a luxury. But going there is absolutely one of the great ways to enhance empathy and understanding. Absolutely. So on the one hand, there are lots of things to do to improve it and lots of ideas. I personally, maybe because I am a writer, I think good writing counts for a huge amount. If you want to get somebody interested in something that she's not already interested in, you have to write something well. And we all know, we've all come across articles about somebody in some other culture we may never even have heard of. And we read through the end because, man, that was really interesting. It was interesting, not simply because other lives are interesting, but because good writing made that possible. On the other side of it, you have to ask, compared to what? So an empathy gap compared to where we were 15 years ago? I'm not sure that that's right. We're certainly not taking advantage of what we have before us now, but it is so much easier now to get information and to have information pushed in front of you about other cultures and other ideas, even if it's just an open comment section, that I'm guessing, and it's merely a guess, that we are likely to be more aware of and possibly more empathetic towards the diversity of cultures on our planet.
Speak to the wisdom gap, if there is such a thing. What we hear is this kind of intense buzz everywhere, but it becomes a kind of white noise. It's not clarion language that moves. It's not Shakespeare. It's not deep reading. It's not art. Are we looking in the wrong place? Will we ever find it on the web?
So it's hard to go up to that level. But if you look at it a little more locally, you are very likely, and I suspect this is the case for you, Chris, for example, in jazz, that you are finding a set of people on the web who you are hanging out with one way or another who you would never have heard from before, but from whom you are learning a great deal, whether it's in their individual writings or seeing them in conversation with others.
You're absolutely right, and I hadn't thought of that. But Jazz on the Tube, it seems to me, is one of the great gifts of the web. Every day I get videos of great, great artists of the 20th century making music that moves me beyond tears. And we didn't know it was out there. But that's surely an example. And it connects you with all sorts of other people and the curators of that site that is heroic, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of, this is one of the things that needs to be said more, which is that there is a culture of heroic generosity on the web. And it's hard not to see that as one of our species' best traits being amplified there. I mean, we see lots of bad traits, but the web is built on a culture of generosity. You know, sending people away from your site to go to somebody else's site by linking to it and saying why you should go.
Right.
That's the basic movement on the web.
I would also note for me, over 10 years, the emergence of Juan Cole, Middle East historian at the University of Michigan, who didn't much like the idea of the war in Iraq, but had covered it every single day from Middle Eastern sources, Arab languages, Hebrew, English, of course, Farsi. He gives you the best wisdom that anybody on the planet, including the CIA, I think, has on what's really going on there. And he would have been writing books and scholarly articles, but suddenly he was a real monitor, gave us something that was simply not available in the press, a huge gift of not necessarily ultimate spiritual wisdom, but facts and insights and angles, perspective and opinion that was available no place else.
Sort of at the other end of this, in a distributed model, is the Andy Carvin example. Andy Carvin is, I forget his title, digital media guru at NPR.
Right.
And during the Arab Spring, he was on Twitter at A. Carvin, by the way. He was following tons and tons of Twitterers from the Arab countries that were in revolt. And he would retweet. And it's some insane number of thousands that he was doing a day. He was up, you know, like 20 hours a day doing this. If you wanted to follow Arab Spring on the ground as it was happening, by far, the best way of doing this was by following Andy Carvin and getting this stream of tweets from real people on the ground. And you begin to see the patterns and of behavior. It is remarkable. And this is, I'm not sure this counts as wisdom. And I don't think you could say that Andy was wise in this. But the outcome of his work, the product of his work, was a type of daily practical distributed wisdom that we couldn't have gotten elsewhere. And wisdom's maybe not the right word, but it was...
good information.
It was...
marvelous information.
Marvelous information coming in the voice of real people.
Exactly. That's a key point. In the voices of the people who are under the bombs or in the squares and with their own lives on the line.
And that's not the only voice we need, of course. Right. We also need...
but we miss it in so much journalism.
Exactly.
Last of the three questions, what about the power gap? It seems to me, you know, the Internet can't vote yet. Corporations can, but how does this heightened awareness, heightened consciousness, begin to register on decisions like, should we attack Iran? It's not being weighed and counted in the so-called deliberations in the Pentagon and the White House.
So on the one hand, it's disappointing that we don't see the Internet mobilizing vast numbers of people to act in their own interest, you know, and to help set government policy. I suspect it's because there's an incommensurability between the Internet and some offline institutions, like the government. The Internet is a bunch of people who are talking and posting, and the government is passing laws and has an army. You know, it's got some pretty direct, and a whole bunch of money. Mm-hmm. It's as if these two entities pass through each other. We are seeing, in multiple ways, I think, signs of using the Internet in order to affect political power. Arab Spring, of course, is one. The use of the Internet in political campaigns by the candidates, but also by the users. The sense that we are entitled to know everything. Before the Internet, you went down to the candidate's headquarters and you got maybe a small handful of documents, one-pagers on their positions. They'd half a dozen of them, that was it. And now we expect full disclosure and long debates and as much detail as we can manage from our candidates. And it's just an expectation that, of course, there will be all this information. And that does change the power relationship indirectly. And as others have pointed out, maybe at this point, the most direct effect of the internet on those sorts of power structures is in the ability to set an agenda, which is only part of what you need to do, but it's something that had been done by the old media and by politicians insofar as they could. But now we get to set the agenda quite often. And so in some sense, as soon as SOPA, the Stop Online Privacy Act, as soon as that became noticed by the internet, it was dead. That was fairly close to inevitable. Mm. That once it became noticed, then there would be a reaction. It was the extent and nature of the reaction was unpredictable. I didn't know there was going to be a blackout. Mm. But setting the agenda in a medium that has as many people involved in it, that is a powerful thing to do. It's not the only thing.
Am I missing something, though, or is there a great gap in the internet speaking, calling attention, raising voices around the world against another war for peace in the Middle East? It seems to me that facile salesmanship is going on through the traditional media, and it's not been opposed. It hasn't even been confronted online yet.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I mean, SOPA affected the internet itself, so it was easier to see that the internet would react. The great democracy of the internet has not exerted itself directly as a great democracy.
Yeah. We'll keep trying. I must say I found all sorts of stimulation and ideas and reality in this description of a kind of open, as you say, transparent, infinitely different, but somehow in the net tolerant space in this world that is still, as you say, too big to know. David Weinberger, always a pleasure. Let's do it again in 10 years, if not once every year for the next 10 years. Thank you. I enjoyed the book hugely.
Well, thank you very much. And whenever you want, Chris, I always look forward to talking with you.